Hello and welcome to Science Unscripted. It's Connor here with you.
And Gabe.
Gabe, you've got an email from someone with an unusual name.
Clank. Gabe, this is Clank on the line. My partner of 23 years, Roxanne, donated one of her kidneys to me on October 8th of this year. I am taking massive doses of immune-suppressing drugs. This is what this is about here. I will be eligible to have a pancreas transplant, an islet cell transplant, and stem cells when they are available. A few weeks back, we talked about a breakthrough out of China where stem cells, for the first time ever, were used in a transplant of the beta cells in the pancreas that produce insulin, the islet cells in the pancreas that produce insulin. That was used for the first time to essentially cure type 1 diabetes.
So if your body can no longer create insulin, lacking, it doesn't have the cells anymore to do it because your immune system has attacked and killed them.
And they don't grow again. When they're dead, they're dead.
Right. So you put the stem cells in there, they regrow them, you can make insulin again. It's great for everyone. But as we established a few weeks back, or as the study itself established, that therapy is highly risky and not for everyone. It's not going to be a mass.
The only way to do a therapy like that is based on somebody else's stem cells is to take immunosuppressant drugs in order to do it, because your body's going to attack those cells once they're introduced to your body. So you have to turn your immune system off, essentially. And that's what Clank gets onto here. He says, my doctor says it goes against all medical ethics to kill someone's immune system just to help them gain better control and stop taking regular insulin injections. And then he concludes here, I've had 2 weeks of immune suppression and I don't think it's worth it. Podcast subscriber Clank. That's absolutely what we said during that broadcast last month, is that this is not for normal type 1 diabetics. No way would any doctor allow you to turn your immune system off just in order to get one of these stem cell transplants. But
interviewed Mark Franca, the Dusseldorf patient who was cured of HIV, one of, I believe, fewer than 10 people in the world whose HIV has vanished from their bodies effectively. Maybe not entirely, but effectively it has. The reason he was able to do that was not because he had HIV and a doctor said, hey, let's cure you of HIV by turning your immune system off and replacing some cells. It was because he had leukemia and he was going to die. And there you've reached a point in terms of medical ethics where you can say, well, if we're going to do that anyway to save his life, this highly risky procedure, which I forget the number now, but it was something like up to 10% of people don't.
15. He had his body, his immune system dialed down with immunosuppressants already, which led the doctor to say, yeah, let's try this. And only then would you say, let's try this, which is why I'm saying to Clank, good luck. Hope everything goes well.
But we're fundamentally with you.
Absolutely.
Clank, in the sense of this is an extreme situation. And there are a lot of ethical questions attached to it. If your life is in danger, doctors can consider it. If it's just a question of not having to inject yourself, you know, in the stomach with insulin on a regular basis, a doctor would say, "There's no way I'm gonna put you down and give you a procedure that is 15% fatal, just so that you don't jab a needle into your side every once in a while."
Yeah, Clank, please let us know how you're doing, whenever you want. All the time, just give us updates. We won't read them out on the air. I just want to know personally. I hope you're okay.
Yeah, I think that was the first time we'd ever heard from him.
Never heard from Clank before. Because we would have, it's a name, you don't see that name every day, so I would have remembered what Clank had written before.
No, but like Gabe said, best wishes to you. We'll move to, well, I guess we're sticking to the idea of jabbing a little needle into your stomach.
Okay.
And this is connected to the idea or the hope or the bold statement that the U.S. at least may have reached peak obesity.
what do you mean peak obesity?
I'm going to kind of lift an idea that was originally published in the Financial Times, which is that in the same way that in the 1960s or prior to the 1960s, cigarettes, we talked about cigarettes and e-cigarettes a couple weeks back.
Yeah.
Cigarettes, more people were using them every year than ever before. And then slowly but surely, there were some messages or some medical messaging coming in. This is bad for you in a variety of ways. We're still figuring out how. At some point, that messaging got through, and the number of smokers, of cigarette smokers, peaked. I think the year was something like 1963. From that point on, it began dropping. That was the peak moment. There was a year where the highest number of, I think, again, it was the U.S., American citizens were putting old-fashioned tobacco cigarettes into their mouths and smoking them. The same may be true with the number of people who are obese. And that's...
What's the turnaround?
Phenomenal news. It's impossible. If that's true, even if it's just plateauing, that is phenomenal news.
What's going on?
We'll get to some of the other theories in a second, but what most people are claiming it has caused this are a couple of new drugs. These are Wegovy is the big one. This is made by a Danish pharmaceutical company that I believe something like 1 in 8 U.S. adults has either already tried or is considering trying. And then you have the Eli Lilly similar drug, and that one is called Zepbound. These are semaglutides. We talked about these drugs on our show, I think it was two and a half years ago. It's been a while since we talked about this. What they do is they mimic the molecule, the semaglutide in there. It mimics a hormone in your brain that says, oh yeah, I'm full. When we talked about it a while back, I was comparing it to other previous attempts at weight loss drugs, which basically amped you up. It was like filling your body with caffeine. So now I'm moving more and now I'm going to lose some weight. Terrible idea with obvious side effects that aren't good. This is a different approach. And when your brain thinks that you are full, even if you're not, going back to insulin production, sends out a signal to monitor or to manage your blood sugar. It also tells you to stop eating, and that's the most important part. You feel satisfied. You feel full even when you are not. An unbelievable amount of people are taking these drugs, is taking these drugs, and I think the number right now is 25,000 people per week are starting them for the very first time.
And they're working so well that we already know that a revolution is taking place with regard to obesity prevalence in the entire United States of America?
Yeah. Yeah. So to give this a little context, from, let's say, the year 2000 up to about 2020, obesity levels in the United States went from 30% up to 40%.
Constant increase.
Yeah. So that's kind of staggering when you really actually break down the percentages, because it looks like, oh, 10% more. It is that. But really, it's a 33% increase in the number of human beings who are obese. This
actual
huge.
Individuals, yeah.
Yeah, this is huge.
And now it's turned around and that curve is going down now?
From 2021 to 2023, it dropped from the peak of 42% roughly to 40.
Wow.
A 2% drop, that's a big deal. That's something to celebrate. A lot of times on the show, a lot of the science we talk about is trying to address a problem that still exists. This is fantastic news. This is absolutely fantastic news. And most people are attributing it to these two drugs. A couple things to say about them. There is data, or there have been studies showing not everyone is sticking to the regimen. So it makes sense. It's an injectable pen, basically, for your stomach. And you do it once a week. And you can continue to increase the dosage over time. But like a lot of drugs, people stop. There are side effects, gastrointestinal, diarrhea, other things going on. One that I couldn't not pay attention to was sulfurous burping. Sulfurous burping. I don't think
sounds like something Roald Dahl would write about.
It does. I imagine like a volcanic bubbling pit or something. Yeah, nobody wants that. And so, yeah, obviously you have to pay attention to potential side effects. And there are a variety of reasons why people aren't sticking with it. Some of that may be cost. Depends on, especially in the U.S., on your healthcare provider. This is a drug that costs, or these drugs cost more than $1,000 per month.
Or not wanting to put a needle in your stomach.
We talked about that with
I got first-hand experience there. I mean, for 20-some years I've been doing it. I wish I could stop.
Does it hurt anymore?
No, but still, you still have to put a needle into your flesh.
Yeah. No, a lot of people have needle phobias. We talked about that way back during the corona pandemic in terms of whether it was affecting the uptake of vaccines, of good vaccines, and how nasal sprays might solve that. Anyway, just a couple more things to say on it. This has led to a drop a measurable drop in heart attack, stroke, and related heart-related deaths. There was one study I took a look at. It showed that if you've already had a cardiac event, this reduces a second one or another one by 20%. And there, so all these knock-on effects for public health care, which are really, really good. And the final benefit, which I just feel like, who's writing these articles? Are the companies behind this writing these articles? Because there's so much positive that's coming out of these drugs. This one was from Addiction, the journal Addiction. They took a look at 100 million patients in 136 U.S. health systems is what they call it. This is a lot of people, yeah. 100 million. And the data was from January 2014 all the way through 2022. Of those 100 million people, 500,000 had opioid use disorders. Another 800 had alcohol use disorders. That dropped. For the people who were taking these drugs, oh, wow. That dropped. Prior to this, there'd been...
So it has an effect on all drives then.
Yeah, yeah. And just to be very clear what we're talking about here, this was... What dropped was opioid overdoses. Those dropped... If the standard was like 100%, then if you're taking the drug, it dropped down to 60%. And with alcohol intoxication, which again, if you have alcohol use disorder, you're supposed to be dry. If you intoxicate yourself, if the standard was 100, it dropped down to 50. If you were taking that, like, yeah, and that's what's really interesting about these semaglutides is what else are they doing? What can they do? And it's something for, at this point, kind of everyone to celebrate if this is the causal factor.
There are no side effects or no known reasons why you shouldn't be taking these or that could be harmful.
One thing,
why doesn't everyone take them?
Right. So one thing, first of all, obviously this is something you need to talk to your doctor about, who will know much more about it than I do at this point. But the one thing that I've read come up is that if you are reducing appetite, this can lead to muscle wasting or your muscles disappearing, which is different than changing your diet. So I would
less protein. Probably.
I would assume that particularly for the elderly, for people who are frail, where a loss in muscle mass becomes dangerous very quickly because you're unable to stop yourself from falling or to brace yourself when you fall, that's something to take into consideration or that your doctor would think about when prescribing or advising these drugs. And of course, there are people who kind of cynically say, well, of course, you know, we just have another drug to solve this crisis that could have been solved in a different way, right? The best thing you can do is to eat healthily and move. I have a tough time myself doing both of those things at the same time or on the same day or even in the same week. We all do, but that is still far superior than an injectable every week. But this seems to be having a lot of positive side effects. Yeah.
All right. You just talked about old people falling there.
Yeah.
Great transition to the research that I'm talking about real quick here.
You've been wanting to talk about this for weeks.
No. You gave me the perfect opportunity, Connor. I had to take the segue. Virginia Tech. They were looking into why old people fall. Average age here, 72 years old. There were 30 people. They had them wear a watch or on their wrist for 3 weeks. In that way, you could log all the data that led to a loss of balance.
Okay. So it's got a gyroscope in there.
Yeah, and 30 people wearing this watch for 3 weeks. And every time they lost their balance, they answered a couple questions about what led to that.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I see. So it was just like a voice recorder?
Yeah. Loss of balance was defined as a sudden, unexpected change in body position that requires us to do something to regain our balance or else we will fall. And they asked when, where, what, why, how, and what was the outcome.
Mm-hmm.
And let me get there. I got an entire map of what led to all these falls. I got all kinds of colors. Huge graph. Here is the crystallized. This is the most important information. If this concerns you out there.
Or if you have parents or loved ones who are.
Because falling is... It has huge implications for the health of old people. This data is limited to the United States, but I'm sure that this is a global phenomenon. Here it is. Just under half of all the losses of balance occurred at 3 p.m. or later, so in the afternoon. 40% were inside the home. almost all were walking on level ground. So it's not when you're going over humps or jumping over anything inside the house. You're walking on level ground inside your house in the afternoon. People tripping.
Anything. They're walking on level ground.
Yep.
And their foot or their toe catches on, I don't know, the edge of a rug or a,
yep.
What is that? Those little threshold bars between in a door frame.
However it is, on level ground in the afternoon and inside the home. That's the data right there. And there weren't as many falls as I thought. So per person, 1.4 losses of balance per week.
That's not bad.
Per week. And of all the fall or losses of balance that happened during this three-week period, none of them resulted in a fall for these 30 people. So
I was going to say 1.4 per week. I might be reaching that already. The difference is... the difference is I'm able to stop it quickly enough and still have, going back to the muscle mass, still have enough to deal with it.
Yeah.
You
probably have a better ability to regain that loss of balance than an older person does who's dealing with muscle issues. The reason why I mentioned this, 1 in 4 seniors in the U.S. falls every year, 2.4 million cases of severe trauma. And another study that came out almost at the same time as this was out of Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. And they were looking at all the people who had fallen and also a diagnosis of dementia. So if you fell, if you for one of these 1 in 4 people who fell during the year, 10% of those people within the next year had been diagnosed with dementia, right?
Yeah.
Which is 20% higher than normal. So this could be a two-way street. Either dementia is causing the fall, or the fall is causing dementia.
That's what I was gonna jump in on, and that would kind of make sense. Or may be connected. We're talking about neurodegenerative diseases and this paravascular system up in your head, which may be connected in, or maybe like your whole vascular system, that if you're not moving, if you're not exercising, if you're not doing things, that it degrades.
Yeah. Couple takeaways from the study. First of all, just make sure that inside your house, all the things that would cause you to trip, get them off the floor, maybe clean up better. And if you do fall, make sure that you have a cognitive screening done within the next year, because based on the numbers, it is much more likely that a diagnosis of dementia is coming.
Last thing I'll say here, and I'm quoting or kind of paraphrasing Peter Attia. We've talked about him on the show before. He had a book on longevity, on health, called Outlive. And there he referenced kind of an associative or correlative study that got my attention, which was just the correlation between grip strength and how long you're going to live. That to kind of simplify it, the stronger you can grip things, the longer you will probably live. I'm thinking, what is that about? Why? Because you can do better handshakes and I don't know, become more powerful through better handshaking. I don't know. No, it's that if you begin to fall, the likelihood is higher that you will be able to catch yourself. So if anyone out there feels that somebody they love is at risk of falling or themselves, it's worth checking in with a doctor or a sports therapist to figure out what can I do to prevent, if I'm going to fall, because all of us are going to fall at certain points, to prevent most of the damage. What part of my body can I work on to try to make sure that I don't have the hardest fall?
A fall killed my grandpa, Einar. He fell walking out the back of the house down the stairs, and a week later he was dead.
Hip?
And there was a railing back there, but maybe now that you say that, I've never thought about this before. If he had stronger grip strength, maybe he would have been able to grab that railing and keep himself up. And then I would have had 5 years longer with Einar, one thing to say before we go, grip strength, the way to train that is what's called a farmer walk.
The best way to train for
grip strength is to take two heavy things and just walk around with them. For as long as you possibly can. Start with a couple pails of water. See how long you can do it. 10 seconds, 20 seconds. Every time you do it, it's a little bit longer by a couple of seconds.
I hate doing it because...
What if that keeps you alive?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. It's a tough exercise because with your arms being pulled down by all that weight, it's harder to get full breaths. And so you feel like you're working hard with shallower breathing.
It also burns.
Yeah, they're hard. Yeah, but what if that's one of the factors that appears to be one of the factors associated with living a longer, healthier life. Leg strength, there are a lot of things that you can do proactively, preventatively, to hopefully avoid that hard fall. Yeah. Anything else you have to say on falling or...
Farmer walking.
Farmer walking or semaglutide drugs. I'd be really interested to know if you've tried them or if you know people who've tried them and whether or not the portrayal that I've just given them is reflected by the experiences you've heard about. Because again, I've been very positive here.
Yeah, give us some bad, give us the negative. We've had way too much positive in this broadcast. How bad are they?
Yeah, I've been trying to be cautious about it. It's just there's so much good news coming out of it. It feels like the press office for these pharmaceutical companies are working overtime and somehow I'm reading that. But
this... Send something to our press office, suatdw.com. Yeah.
So it's easy to think that if you, I don't know, you're looking at someone, you're looking at a stranger, that the way you're going to judge them, the way you're going to think about them is based on what? My life experience, the other people I've met who are like them, or the things I've learned, the books I've read, the movies I've consumed, the lessons, the ethics I've absorbed from my parents and from the people around me.
No, that's what you would like to think. You would like to think it's who you are, who you've become. That's what shapes what you think about other people. But what if it's just the chemicals in your brain?
And what if you can alter those chemicals through a nasal spray to change someone's opinion for the worse on someone of the opposite sex? That is the... I was going to say tantalizing. Is it tantalizing? That's the amazing experiment... That Francesca
Luberti of Nipissing University, that's what they did. Let's talk to her about that right now.
Science Unscripted.
Hi, I'm Francesca Luberti, and I'm a researcher who studies the social context and physiological processes that might influence social and political attitudes. And when I was a postdoctoral researcher at Nipissing University in Canada, my colleagues and I conducted an experiment that tested whether testosterone can affect men's dehumanization of women.
And does it, Francesca? Does testosterone affect whether or not men dehumanize women?
Well, we found that testosterone did increase dehumanization toward a woman dressed more conservatively. Although men already dehumanized a woman dressed in more revealing clothing, and in that case, testosterone did not make those effects even worse.
Okay, Francesca, and I've read a little bit about your study here, so let me just provide a little bit of the context so that people listening to this know what's going on. You had two groups of men, and you were showing them videos of women who were dressed in a revealing way and ones who were dressed in what you called a conservative way. And these two groups of men were either given a shot of testosterone sprayed in their nostrils or not. And the ones who had testosterone shot into their noses thought that the women who were dressed less revealingly or more conservatively thought that they were less human, or that they weren't able to have emotions that were uniquely human. Is that what happened?
If they were on placebo, they didn't engage in emotion-based dehumanization toward her. But if they were on testosterone, they did. While the men that watched the video of the woman wearing more revealing clothing engaged in this form of dehumanization regardless of their testosterone levels. What it seems that this increase in testosterone levels did was increasing emotion-based dehumanization toward the woman, even when she was dressed conservatively.
So here, of course, you're doing this in a lab. You're spraying testosterone into their noses. But of course, the implication is about the real world. So I guess my question is, when would I or when would a man out in the real world potentially have a natural testosterone spike that might cause us to look at conservatively dressed women differently?
Yeah, so there are many ways in which testosterone levels can spike. And with this intranasal dose, we would try to mimic exactly that. So we increased the men's testosterone levels to their high normal physiological levels. But it's things like there's been a lot of research that has shown that brief social interactions with an attractive woman can spike testosterone levels, things like a fight in a bar, even watching sports, watching your team win a match, things like that.
So if this works in one direction from men toward women with testosterone, then my assumption would be that it also works the other direction, women emotionally dehumanizing men, possibly with a different hormone, with a different molecule. Does it? I'm just guessing here.
Yeah, and women have testosterone too, lower levels on average than men, but they have testosterone too. So it'd be definitely interesting to see whether like increasing women's testosterone level would result in women's dehumanizing men. But yeah, we'll have to see. That'll be an interesting like future study to do.
That was Francesca Luberti talking to us from northeastern Canada, essentially.
Yeah, and for those of you still left wondering, well, what am I supposed to do with this information, right? If you spray testosterone up into somebody's nose, they're going to devalue, at least emotionally, the person sitting across from them. In this case, a man will devalue the emotional complexity of a woman. Mm. I think it's still useful just to know that. Right. And if you are in a situation where you might have accidentally seen your testosterone spike, what was it? You're watching a sports game, or you are in a situation, you see somebody fighting, see a fight happen, or you're concerned that you might be involved in a fight yourself, to be aware that that is going to change you, at least temporarily, kind of for the worse, possibly. And that's a state you can be in.
Yeah. I've never thought about the word dehumanize in that way. When I've seen that word dehumanization, it's normally with regard to atrocities that have happened by war criminals, but that we can do that, dehumanize other people based simply on a chemical in our brains that we maybe think don't have control over. That's what opened my eyes on this one.
That's kind of good news, right? Don't worry. Hey, it's not your fault. You're like you could kind of frame it that way. Mm-hmm. You're not in control of yourself. These are chemicals flowing. I guess even more concretely than just knowing this and being aware of it, if you're around a group of people, and in this case, guys, right? The study was about guys, and someone starts making some kind of nasty comments. I mean, at least you know this now. You can wonder or even have the courage to say, like, what's up? Are you on a testosterone high?
Yeah, are you jacked up on tea?
Yeah, have you been watching too many sports, or are you watching people? I don't know. I don't have the right way to say it at this point, but it can lead, at the very least, it can lead to that discussion or to that thought, even.
At least something to think about. What do you guys think? Let us know at SUDW.com.
Science Unscripted. Thank you. DW, made for minds.